Today's program is brought to you by the Museum of Food and Drink, sparking curiosity about food with exhibits you can eat. For more information, visit mofad.org.
Thank you for listening to Heritage Radio Network. We are a member-supported nonprofit food radio station. That means that every single thing we do, from broadcasting 35 weekly shows for free, to bringing you exclusive content from sold-out food events across the country, to offering scholarships to high school students, is only possible thanks to the support of our loyal members. And we want you to join the club. Become a member during our 2017 summer drive to get access to sweet swag and pledge your support to the world's only food radio station. Visit heritageradionetwork.org/donate to become a member now.
Welcome to Food Without Borders, a show about food, politics, and identity. I'm your host, Sari Kamen. My guest today is Tunde Wei. He is a Nigerian-born chef who has created several dinner series that inspire guests to discuss themes of race and immigration. Welcome to the show, Tunde.
What's up?
Hey, what's up? You're coming to me from New Orleans. Thank you so much for chatting with me today.
Thank you for having me. It's dope. I didn't know you guys gave scholarships out to high school kids. That's amazing and interesting.
Yeah, it is cool. We just did a program where we did some mentoring with high school kids and helped them create their first radio stories. And actually, the girl that I worked with, this really cool girl, Nia, she did a story about her own sort of immigration experience and connecting to her culture through food, which is great because that's sort of the topic of my show. So it worked out really well. Yeah.
Yeah.
So what's going on in New Orleans? What are you working on?
Currently? Like right this second?
Just like in general, like just kind of fill me in on like what sort of projects you're working on right now.
I'm actually writing, sort of finishing up this essay that is going to be published in the San Francisco Chronicle on it's a little too expansive, but the broad themes are racism and patriarchy.
So
that's what I'm working on right now, writing and just trying to figure out how to transition my dinner series, which you mentioned at the top of the show, into a more full-fledged or a less itinerant production, you know, like just housed in one place.
Yeah, like laying down some roots.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
All those words to say what you just said.
Right.
That's exactly what I mean.
I want to talk about your dinner series. You've done two different separate series at this point. Is that right? Or more?
Let's just say two that are relevant to what you're talking about. I started the first dinner series that I did was, it didn't have an explicitly political theme. I was just cooking Nigerian food and sort of like railing against popular food culture.
What about popular food culture kind of inspired you to, I don't know, create something, I guess, adversarial with food?
Everything, right? Like, everything from what sort of food genres or food types were celebrated, you know, so usually Eurocentric sort of food or Eurocentric techniques, European stuff, the way food is plated, just sort of the lack of or the self focus and the pretentiousness of the food. So the food is just concerned with itself. You know, it didn't talk about anything else. And then the extraction of food, the passing of flavors, like all of these aspects of contemporary food culture were the things that bothered me initially when I first started cooking Nigerian food. And I used Nigerian food as a counterbalance to what I thought was frivolous indulgence in in dining, you know?
So you kind of looked around at popular restaurant culture and identified like a certain amount of, I don't know, gratuitousness and wanted to like connect with your heritage as a way to counter that?
Yeah, I mean, that would make me sound more calculating than I am. I owned a restaurant in Detroit, and what we did at the time was we had different chefs come in to cook at that restaurant, and most of the chefs that we had come in were very talented, and they were cooking sort of in the tradition of the time, which, you know, that time still continues, sort of like new modern American food, and the food was without a doubt delicious. At least that was the consensus, even apart from myself, because I soon realized that I couldn't tell the difference between good food and food that I wasn't quite excited about, because my palate had been trained differently, being that I'm from Nigeria and that's the food that I had. So it was based on my observations of the food that we served at my restaurant and the reaction that that food got from the media and from our diners, and the orthodoxy that was spreading, or that was classifying it, and how people were, you know, were just becoming more and more interested in seeing a particular thing in the culinary sense. They were interested in like using radicchio or whatever it's called, or Maya lemon, or bone marrow, and presenting it in the same sort of way. And I was just, I couldn't understand it. I wasn't connected to it emotionally or even intellectually. And based on that experience, I felt like the answer to that whole question was to sort of like serve the food that I grew up eating, which is Nigerian food, which is pretty blunt and expressive. At the same time, it doesn't, its nuance is different, you know. It announces itself, the flavors announce themselves, you know, at the fore, and then nuance happens afterwards. And it's unpretentious. There isn't any sort of abstraction around the meal. We're not discussing or dissecting how good, you know, soup tastes. We just eat it, you know, and then we let the meal be the background and the backdrop for other more relevant conversations, you know. Mm-hmm. So that was sort of like how it started.
I mean, that's interesting because I think most people will go to a restaurant and eat food and then judge it based on how it tasted. Like, yeah. If, you know, they might taste Meyer lemon and think like, oh, that's sweet. And this, whatever you said, bone marrow is like rich and decadent. And like that, those are all good things. Like this is pleasant. Like this tastes delicious to me. And then would judge the meal like based on that quality. So you're saying that like, despite the fact that it might have tasted good because it didn't sort of resonate with you in, I don't know, like a more abstract way or a way that connected you, maybe nostalgically, that it didn't feel meaningful?
Yeah, and plus, it's like contemporary food culture is too abstract. But it's abstract in a way that isn't even intellectually interesting. You know, it's abstract because we have excess capital and excess time for our leisure. So the abstractness has come about because we're trying to distract ourselves. You know, we're not, like, generally when we abstract, like, feelings, or we abstract concepts, they are for, like, a greater intellectual purpose, you know. But with food, the only purpose was just to escape everything else. So you're eating at the table, and you're bringing out your camera, you're taking pictures of the food, and then you're talking about the food, and then you're talking about the food to other people who are next to you and asking people what they think. And like, it's just like this rabbit hole of navel gazing that is kind of dizzying. Mm. You know, and there's no to me, and I don't want to be too broad, there is validity in that sort of approach, but the whatever benefit that might come of that, it's slim compared to the loss of simple enjoyment and company of the food and of friends in a setting where the food is served. So I'm just not, I mean, I have been cooking and I've been talking about food now, I think, for like 3 or 4 years. So I'm unfortunately, like, I catch myself falling into those same traps, talking about the food that I'm eating, talking about food. But generally, I'm not interested in critiquing the flavor of food. I'm interested in critiquing the flavor of food when that points to something else. Mm-hmm. That points to, for example, who's cooking this food? Where does this food come from? What are the underlying and invisible structures that hold this food up, that make this food possible in this space at this time with me eating it, you know?
Yeah, I understand. I mean, that seems like that was the purpose of your dinner series, and you use food kind of as a conduit for a conversation. But and I want to talk more about the specifics of that, but I think it would be helpful to hear a little bit about your background and then understand like where you're coming from and why this has been your trajectory. So would you mind just speaking a little bit about like your experience growing up in Nigeria and then immigrating to the United States?
It was blissful. Africa was just amazing. Just animals everywhere. Fruits on the floor. You just pick them up, you eat them, and you walk away. I'm kidding. That's not how it was.
I was going to say, that sounds really great. Why would you leave?
I don't know. I had a middle-class upbringing. You know, I went to school, came home, watched television, did like regular stuff, I guess, that most Americans would be familiar with. Mm-hmm. There wasn't anything particularly extraordinary about growing up in Nigeria. And then I moved here when I was 16. I moved here for college. Tried college for a while, didn't quite stick. So then I stopped going to college. The story is more complex than that, but that's sort of the shorter story. And so I stopped going to college. But I came here. I came to America on a student visa. And when I stopped going to school, my visa lapsed, and so I became undocumented. And so I sort of just spent a lot of time, just living, you know, without really doing anything. Mm-hmm. Which doesn't really explain what I was doing, because I was doing things, but I feel like nothing mattered. Like, all the stuff that I was doing didn't matter so much, or their value weren't apparent until, like, say, 2011, when, a series of events brought me back to Detroit. Because when I moved here 17 years ago, I first moved to Detroit, and then moved out of the city, and I moved back, you know, traveling between the suburbs and the city, and, you know, over 10 years living in different places. But in 2011, I moved back to the city. And I just started working out of Detroit, working and living there. And that was the beginning of a rediscovery and like a personal rediscovery. Like, Detroit just like didn't save my life really, but it showed me my life, you know? And it was in Detroit that I made the necessary relationships that I had and I still have to open up my first restaurant, which was like totally happenstance. You know, I was, just came out of a conversation with a friend, and he was talking about opening up a restaurant. I'm like, fuck it, let's do it. And 3 months later, we had a space, we had everything, and we were opening up, and I didn't quite know what I was doing, but we did it. And that was the restaurant that I mentioned earlier, where we had different chefs come into the restaurant and cook pre-fee meals, multi-course meals. And, it, you know, it was pretty successful, maybe not monetarily, but in terms of the influence and the access and the opportunities that came after that. And so I did that for a year. And then, you know, towards the end of that year, well, towards the end of the first year opening the restaurant, that was when I started really having this sort of conflict with the food, which kind of overstates the shit, because I wasn't like going back home at night and like, oh my God, I can't sleep because American food is so fucked up. You know, it wasn't like that. It was just like, you know, I'm like, oh, I don't understand this bullshit, you know.
What do you think changed in you? What do you think shifted that you started to have these conflicting feelings about the food?
Again, I don't want to overstate like my sensitivity towards American food. It's not that deep, but there was a particular moment where I remember we were serving food, like, again, one of these like really wonderful 6-course meals at the restaurant, and we were playing like a Notorious B.I.G. song, you know.
Uh-huh.
And then somebody, an older lady, said, asked me to change the music back to Miles Davis because that sort of jazz went better with the food. And I was just like, what the fuck?
Mm.
Like, what are you saying? You know, like, I guess now, even back then, like, all the hip restaurants play rap music and shit. So it's not as scandalous to play rap music now. But I felt like in that moment, there were so many obvious things, right? The fact that, you know, that jazz was the rap of its day,
mm-hmm.
you know, and jazz had become sanitized and lost its sort of like, or has seemingly lost its revolutionary message. And rap is sort of this revolutionary form of music, but has been co-opted by commercial forces like everything does. And all of that spoke to the space that I was in, this restaurant, which we started off as a provocative exercise that was slowly being standardized into another conventional restaurant under the guise of innovative, you know? And then I was like, plus, in my mind, I'm like, plus, this food, I don't even understand this shit. Like, it's delicious, but I don't understand what the food is saying. It's just, like, too much. It's too precious. Too much is happening, and I just don't want to really deal with this sort of food. And I want to cook the shit that I eat and I grew up eating. So,
yeah, I mean, there's definitely a tension that you're identifying, because I think most people go out to eat because they're pursuing comfort, and you seem to kind of reject the notion that food is just purely pleasure. Like, food should be provocative, as you said before, and it was kind of losing its edge. But I think it's difficult but it's a challenge, I think, to serve people delicious food, but also try and, remove, you know, like the sort of the comforting nature of it. But maybe you can talk about, like, in your dinner series, how you've been able to achieve that.
Well, I would say a couple of things. Mm-hmm. I don't think food is exclusively an arena to have uncomfortable conversations and, you know,
certainly not. Yeah,
our rancor. That would be too much. I think that we have, you know, broadly speaking, two kinds of spaces, right? Public spaces and private spaces. I think in private spaces, food can be whatever we want food to be. I think in public spaces, we need to think more critically about what food can be and should be, and that we and I'm talking about, I guess, the general food culture, for a long time have been experiencing the benefits of this great wealth that this country has, and food has been rising in prominence as sort of wealth has been growing and more people have, or you know, I guess the middle class has been expanding, and all of that, all these like wonderful socioeconomic realities. But the food still has a primary purpose, right? Which is to satiate our hunger and to nourish us. That's what it is primarily. And there are restaurants there are restaurants which address this. You know, these are utilitarian restaurants. You go there and you go there to eat because you're hungry. You're not going there for an experience. You're not going there for a light show or you know, a cabaret. Mm-hmm. You're going there to eat and then you're leaving. And then there are other spaces that recognize food as entertainment. And so these are the spaces that I'm talking about. The spaces that that have really come about from the fat of the system, right? The excess wealth has been created that now needs to find a purpose elsewhere. And these spaces are the spaces that I'm critical about, because these spaces are just serving food and entertainment without any moral message. You know, it's just come here and eat and, like, get the fuck away from your life. And it's a double jeopardy. It compounds the problem, right? That we, because of our excesses, have created restaurants that support entertainment, are inviting people to come and be excessive in these spaces without considering the consequences of what they're doing. And that's why I think those food spaces that celebrate escapism and entertainment have a duty to be more conscious and to be more overtly political. At least that's what I feel. And that's the work that I'm trying to do with the dinner series and with whatever sort of restaurant space I eventually land in.
So what are some ways, I mean, I want to hear the specifics of how you're doing it, but what are some ways that, you know, your sort of typical fine dining restaurant where, you know, primarily the purpose is to create an experience where diners can kind of, you know, to use your words, like escape the hardships and the often difficult realities and the burden of life and just kind of enjoy and savor the food. What are some ways that you feel that they can, I don't know, incorporate more of a moral message into the dining experience?
I don't know. I mean, I find it hard to be prescriptive, mm-hmm. you know, but I can speak to the stuff that I'm doing.
Okay,
you know,
please
or that I want to do. I don't know what other people should do, but, and people could sort of like view my perspective as extreme. I think that we should have, and I'm working to create restaurants that are politically explicit in their position. You know, that say or broadcast very clearly what their politics are. And so what that means is just literally restaurants where you can talk about politics, where you can talk about race, where you can talk about gender and economics and pain and trauma, like restaurants that do that. That's what I'm interested in creating. And I don't know if there's no like magic pill, like, you know, I don't have like smoke machines, like billowing smoke and like, you know, firebombs happening. It's just like people sit down and just talk. That's it. They talk and they eat. And every place or every like point of contact between the restaurant and the diner is affected by the politics of the space. So maybe the menu has explicit political messaging on it. The decor is politically vibrant. The staff, you know, represent their politics embody their personal politics, like all of that. You know, the format of the restaurant, the hours the restaurant keeps, the sort of food that the restaurant sources, like all of that shit. You know, I mean, there's a perfect example of a restaurant that's doing this right now. It's Conflict Kitchen in Pittsburgh.
Yeah,
it's a great example. Mm-hmm. I mean, there are other, not so much restaurants, but food collectives that are doing this work, like the People's Kitchen in the Bay Area, and Nourish Resist in the Bay as well, and Food Lab Detroit in Detroit. There are different people who are using food to advocate for a different kind of communal space, using food to organize, in a sense. And so that's the only prescription I can offer, is the one that I'm trying to do, just create spaces that explicitly demand conversations that are socially, culturally, politically difficult but necessary to have.
Yeah. So for your most recent dinner series, which was about immigration, what role did the food play? Like, other than create a setting where people could come together and talk, you wouldn't necessarily have to be eating in order to have that kind of conversation. So how did you use the food to stimulate the conversation?
I don't know. I just put the food in front of people. My current theory on food is, food is like the air that we breathe, you know? So it's like, if you ask me, like, you know, in tough international negotiations, how was oxygen used to deliver a compromise? Mm. I mean, it wasn't used. The oxygen exists. Without the oxygen, like, you can't breathe. So you can't, like, reach a compromise on, you know, on peace or anything. You know. So for me, that's how I treat food. I think food should be there. Food is the background. It's the important background. The food has to be delicious, of course. The care and attention to detail has to be there. People have to love the food. But people, in my opinion, should leave unable to unstitch the experience of the conversation from the food, from the atmosphere, from whatever is stirred in them that they carry throughout and past that conversation. That all of that stuff should be one sort of unitary ball of revelation. But that's how I feel. So I don't know how to answer that question in terms of, like, what the food does. I'm trying to make the food as invisible but as relevant as possible.
That's challenging, I would imagine. Tunde, this is so fascinating. We're going to take a quick break to hear from our sponsor, and then we'll be right back to continue this conversation.
This is the story of men and women who shed not only their clothes, but also their...
Hi, I'm Dave Arnold, the host of Cooking Issues on the Heritage Radio Network. We all know and love Chinese takeout dishes like General Tso's chicken and egg rolls, but here's the thing. Even though we call it Chinese food, it's not like the food you'd find in China. What's the story behind this cuisine, and how did it become so popular that you can find a Chinese-American restaurant in nearly every town in the country? The answers may surprise you. Visit the Museum of Food and Drink in Brooklyn and see our newest exhibition, Chow, Making the Chinese-American Restaurant. Chow engages visitors with compelling accounts of how Chinese immigrants overcame racism and created Chinese-American cuisine. Discover the science behind the flavors of your favorite takeout dishes, feast on rotating tastings developed by the country's most talented Chinese-American chefs, and try your hand at writing your own fortune, which will be baked into actual cookies by a 1,500-pound fortune cookie machine. But what better way to learn, connect, and eat? You can visit Chow at the Museum of Food and Drink on Fridays through Sundays from noon to 6. Tickets and more information can be found at mofad.org.
Hi, I'm Linda Palacio, host of A Taste of the Past here on Heritage Radio Network. Using food as a lens to observe history and culture, I take you on a weekly journey through different topics of culinary history. Tune in on Thursdays at noon to hear about the history of such topics as American cake, the accidental churning of butter, pho, the Vietnamese soup craze, and so much more. And help us keep this and other heritage programming alive. Go to heritageradionetwork.org and click on the beating heart to donate and continue enjoying great programs.
Hey, you're listening to Food Without Borders. We've been talking with Tunde Wei. He is in New Orleans right now, speaking to me over the phone. He's a Nigerian chef who's been working on a dinner series that raises issues of immigration and race, and he uses food to kind of bring people together and create a setting where tough conversations can happen. So, Tunde, I was wondering, you've been working on these dinner series and using food in a very sort of provocative way. Has this been something that you've always been inspired to do, like work with food in this way, or has it been more recently because Trump is in office?
It's been more recently. It's predated Trump, but I get my first, I guess, actively political dinner series was 2016 in March. I mean, I started considering that. I started like laying the foundation for that dinner series at the end of 2015, so the fall of 2015, and I started in the spring of 2016, and that dinner series was about race, and it was, I guess, my sort of opportunity to personally reflect in a public space about black identity and what that meant for me, and to come to terms with how blackness was understood on a scale larger than me and independent of me, and that sort of coincided, or rather was inspired, which is a terrible word, but it was inspired by the state of publicized killings of black folks by the police, mm-hmm. Around that time. And so that was sort of the impetus behind the dinner series at the time. So it's a recent, recent marrying of food and political discourse that I'm doing.
And how has your agenda changed? I mean, I know it went from race to immigration, and those are both very, you know, personal issues for you, but how have things changed for you, you know, since this last election took place, and how do you feel just like as someone who's immigrated to this country and is like a vocal undocumented immigrant, how has that affected your personal identity?
Yeah, I should say about my status is that I am, and this may not mean anything to folks, but I'm like, I guess more accurately, administratively undocumented. Mm-hmm. Like, I am not, I think, at least that's what my lawyer tells me, I'm not in the same sort of predicament as most folks who are undocumented. Like, I'm undocumented, I got arrested and detained, and so I was released on bond, and I'm also married, so I have this weird, I exist in this weird place where I don't have status, but I have some sort of very thin veneer of protection, which might not mean anything when I'm traveling tomorrow, who knows. But I just want to make a distinction between, I guess, the varying levels of anxiety that folks who are without papers face. And mm-hmm. I just want to say that. In terms of like Trump, the dinner series, the current dinner series on immigration, or the most recent dinner series on immigration, is really born from the dinner series on race, because immigration is ultimately about race. It's about othering. It's about discrimination. That's just what it is about. But on a hyperlocal and on a global scale simultaneously. And I, you know, I don't buy this explanation that Trump's immigration policy is somehow divorced from the sentiment of most Americans. I don't think that's true. I think that if you consider, like I said, immigration as a question of movement, for example, between different kinds of spaces, between, for example, hyperlocal geographies, so between neighborhoods, and also between social spaces, then you see that a lot of Americans, regardless of where they are on the political spectrum, live their lives in such a way as to create these boundaries, whether it's school districts, for example, that that concentrate wealth in a particular community, or whether it's, you know, their social groups, like all of these things, the aggregate of them, you know, create the sum of the current immigration policy that we have. And so my personal feelings about the Trump administration are, this is America. This is what America is. You know, America is this. And I don't care if you're liberal or if you think you're conservative. Everybody bears, to a certain degree, some responsibility for fostering the immigration system that we have. fostering the uniquely American divisions based on race and class, but also the global divisions based on nationality.
So you're saying America were to hold up a mirror to itself, the reflection would be Trump?
Some of the reflection would be Trump. I mean, I just think that trying to caricaturize Trump or trying to villainize Trump is not in my mind the most effective way of creating the sort of change that we want to see. Like, yes, you know, they are very real and dangerous policies, and I'm, for example, particularly vulnerable to them. These policies that Trump and his administration present, and so there has to be work, real policy work, organizing that goes into fighting those, fighting that reality. But just as important is the personal work that we have to do to recognize the shit that we carry, mm-hmm. you know, the shit that continues to entrench the society in very clear and discreet spaces, you know, based on race, again, based on gender, based on class. You know, they are a vast interlocking network of oppressive power structures, of which Trump is a reflection, but he is not the entire reflection. You know, the reflection also looks like Hillary Clinton, also looks like Bernie Sanders, also looks like me, you know? So I don't know if that makes sense. I'm not trying to create an equivalency between, for example, Trump and Hillary Clinton, because I think there's a clear difference. What I'm trying to say, though, is that there's a tendency, which I realized, for example, in my dinner series, in when confronting a serious problem, folks are very quick to externalize the problem mm-hmm. And blame other people and distance themselves from it, either through political affiliation, so they'd be like, oh, well, I'm liberal and Trump is a conservative, so that's not, I mean, I didn't contribute to that. But mm-hmm. that's not true. Like, the problem that exists without, especially in America, is fed from within, and that's, I guess, a huge part of what my dinner series is about. Like, we have to come to terms with the shit that we carry unspoken, unsaid, and unresolved, because that shit eventually manifests.
You're just advocating for everybody to do better themselves personally. And if that means, you know, having dinner be a somewhat uncomfortable experience every now and then so be it. Yeah. Are you planning any more dinner series upcoming, or are you just kind of staying grounded like you mentioned earlier?
I'm currently just chilling.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. I would love to have you reach out, you know, to the network and tell us how we can follow your work. And like, if you do have any more dinner series coming up, I know that I personally would want to know about that. And I'm sure other listeners would too. What's the best way to kind of stay connected, to what you're working on?
I have a website, fromlagos.com, and yeah, to that. And then Instagram, which is just pictures of food and New Orleans, really.
But yeah, that sounds nice.
Yeah.
Okay, great. Well, Tunde, this is so interesting and fascinating. And thank you so much for taking the time to share your experience and your story. And I'm just so privileged to have you as a guest today. And I hope to experience one of your dinners at some point, whether it be here or in New Orleans or wherever you are, because I'm sure it'll be very thoughtful and, you know, delicious in spite of itself.
Thank you so much for being patient with me and listening to me talk. I appreciate it.
It was really my pleasure. Thank you all so much for tuning in to Food Without Borders. We'll see you next week, same time, Wednesday, 5 p.m. EST.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you.
For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.